collapse down to the correct answer. How you do that, I don't really know, because it's incredibly esoteric. But, you know, the more qubits you have, the less noise you have, the less loss of entanglement you have, the better to use the quantum computing algorithms to factor in the product of prime numbers. But, you know, how they correlate, I don't exactly know, and I think the experts don't quite know yet. They're tinkering around. They're trying to expand the number of qubits and the sustainability and decreasing the background noises so that the results are accurate. But I don't think they've factored any kind of already in-use encryption products of prime numbers yet. They've proved that you could get a product of two prime numbers and factor it, but right now, again, as far as I understand, they're single-digit numbers, which is not something that you need a quantum computer for. But if they're able to extend all the specifications, their hope is that eventually they will have a breakthrough moment where they'll be able to do it to much larger products.
Yeah, I can say a couple more things.
KD2 follow sure. With sidebar information.
Okay, George, give us some sidebar information, and then we'll go back to Gary.
No, take Gary first. I'll stand by.
Okay, Gary?
Yeah, okay. Well, as you said, the two, you know, key things about quantum computing is superposition and also an entanglement. And the problems that they're having are stability, basically, coherence time and error correction and things like that. And they're using these various methods in order to try to address those problems. But in any case, the logarithmic problem, in other words, coming up with a quantum algorithm, you know, is looking at the profile of probability states that exist in superposition, you know, trying to predict the probability of any given outcome in all these multiple outcomes that become possible with superposition. It's a probability calculation, and I think that they're probably well on their way to developing the next order of magnitude here, and I think they're 20 years down the line is probably probably too far a thing. I think it's closer, but you know, what do I know? It just seems to me anyhow. And that's go ahead, George, go ahead and then give it back to web control.
Roy, to you first.
No, it's okay, George. Take it away for now.
As a sidebar to this, what I've been learning in the economic world is that in the next few years, anywhere from 3 to 6 to 7 years, we are going to be experiencing more in cost. Cost and inflation in energy and equipment that we need, cell phones, automobiles, which have tremendous amount of chip need for them. The bottom line is that the energy to support is going to be taken away from what we need. Development of chips has not exceeded the need. It is not keeping up with the need for AI development or higher intelligent computerization development. It's going to hurt us as a consumer. Products that we need that have been placed with chips over the last 10 to 15 years, automobiles, stoves, refrigerators, everything, and of course the advancement of the I'm not going to say the cell phone, but the smartphones, as everybody has in front of them, televisions, everything. All of this is going to suffer because those industries are going to be putting up a tremendous amount of money to step in front of us as a consumer. They, as a consumer, will be getting more of the products that we need immediately over the next 3 to 5 years. Without a doubt. Energy. Companies that provide electricity are making deals with them. Remember, if you need 15, 20, 30, 30,000 times more chips to provide AI, you're consuming electricity. Oh, they're going to give it to them cheap? You better believe it. Because of their consumer. I mean, our local energy company is going up 12% a year for electricity. Unheard of in anybody's lifetime that I know of. And we're all around the same age. So we're going to suffer before we gain what this part of industrial development is going to deliver. Back to you, Roy. KD2FIU.
AC2GS. Well, I would disagree with you as far as, because we started this conversation with quantum computing. Quantum computing is not really impacting on fabrications or power generation. Artificial intelligence is wreaking havoc with all of those. Regular products, computers are going to get more expensive, laptops, anything with memory chips is going to get more expensive because the major fabricators of memory have shifted from the type of memory used for the products we're used to so that they could put more of them on AI boards. So and also energy. People are taking a lot of the power meant for the local, towns. You know, they come into these towns and they promise them jobs for the first, 6 months of building these server stations. And they don't mention that once they're built, it's going to be a small number of workers who maintain it, but they're going to need megajoules of power from their power facilities, and competition is going to drive the price up. So I agree with you entirely as far as artificial intelligence developments and the purchase of all these things. Right now, the bottleneck is not fabrication of AI chips right now. It's primarily building the facilities and the powering them. That is the bottleneck. There's a lot of servers that are not even being built yet because they can't get the loan money to pay people to build the darn things. So it's going to wreak havoc all kinds of ways, and I've mentioned it repeatedly with my little AI talk. But it's AI, I think, that's manifesting this. Now, if it is a bubble and the bubble bursts, there's going to be a lot of server facilities that are going to go unutilized. That's really not going to mean a heck of a lot to us because there's not much you and I can do with a surplus server farm. Even the memory chips, if they tried to repurpose them, they're different types of memory chips. So our laptops and our desktops and all our computer type of equipment is going to go up in price. There's not much we can do about it. You know, there's at least more than $1 trillion being overinvested in AI. And unless they build the super god computer, the stuff that generative AI does and the amount of money that business and people will pay for it is not going to pay back the trillions of dollars invested in this bubble.
KD2FIU with AC2GS, and Roy, you just reminded me of something which had to do with the overdevelopment of fiber optic facilities 25 years ago. And they mentioned that that it was necessary for the development of communications in this country, and then all of a sudden the industry collapsed. It had collapsed to a point where we were not seeing it, and a lot of people lost money who were investing in it. And guess what? The capacity of all of that has simply been exceeded 15 years later. So if they're going over and they're exceeding development right now in this product delivery, they're going to leave it in place, not simply with the same technology, but they will leave it in place, and within a few years, even less than 15, even less than 10, and maybe 5, they will be developing it larger. Back to you, Roy.
Well, I mentioned a little bit earlier that I didn't kind of mention about the dot-com bubble. The dot-com bubble left a bunch of infrastructure that couldn't be utilized at that time but could be easily repurposed and used later on when the infrastructure grew up around it. That's not the case for AI. If we never get anything past approximately our present level with generative AI, then a lot of the promises for future trillions of dollars of profit simply will not exist utilizing the infrastructure. And you can repurpose fiber optics as much as you want. There's only a few different types of fiber optics out there, and they've aged very well in 15, 20 years. You can't do that with AI. The NVIDIA chips and boards will be out of date by 5 years. They will be rust buckets and need to be replaced with new silicon. So it doesn't. You can't kind of use the same logic for a dot-com bubble and an AI bubble.
Got two more thoughts.
Oh, okay, Gary, real quick. I want to say this. You may not know the actual chemical structure of the industry behind early transmission lines. A lot of that stuff disappeared right away. The fiber signals, you have fiber optics, and you have signals going over fiber optics. That changed so quickly that a lot of that was, just as you were saying, went away. All right, what's happening with these chips? How do you know that 5 years from now they're going to erode and not be capable? I don't know whether you meant in a form of chemistry, and I'm sorry, I'll put this aside, and Roy, I'll let you get it on with Gary, but I'm going to put this aside. Was it chemistry, or was it just the entire reading of what is going on with it?
No, it's the inherent technology. In a vacuum, unless the world kind of crumbles, the science behind the technology of building chips will increase. You'll be able to have more memory on the chips. You'll be able to have faster clock times. You'll be able to do sophisticated mathematics and scale it. The AI chips that you buy from NVIDIA today didn't exist a year ago, and those didn't exist the year before that. Every year or two, they've upscaled the technology of the chips. So, if say 5 or 10 years the world changes a little and you're capable and you're able to kind of use AI chips, you'll tend to want the latest, greatest ones, because by then I can't kind of guess exactly, but it wouldn't be unusual to upscale 10 or 20 or 100 times. So, would you rather have slower chips that use up the same amount of power, or faster chips that do more operations that use less power? So most of the investment in the chipsets, which is a major investment, is kind of, they'll be selling them on pennies on the dollar, because most people will want the most efficient means to run a server farm. So even the companies involved in it admit that they some people say that it's a three-year lifespan. Some people say it's a five-year lifespan. No one that I am aware of says it's a 10-year lifespan. So it has a finite life, unfortunately, because of the expected developments in the technology that you can see through the last 20 years.
Comment about Kibbe.
Okay, Wes.
Oh, Gary's in there. Roy, Gary is in there.
Okay, yeah, let's hear from Gary, and then you can come back, Wesley, okay?
KG2RY.
David, recognize. Hold up for a second. David, Gary, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, just quickly, since you guys were talking about fiber optics, it is a fact that over short distances, quantum information can be transmitted over fiber optic cables, and they're even thinking about, you know, quantum repeaters and things like that. But that's an aside. You know, since things like, you know, chemistry and nanotechnology are very much dependent on quantum understanding, you can look to quantum computing in the future to devise new materials that don't exist today, perhaps, that can solve problems like fusion and energy generation and things like that, you know. It seems to me that it's a technology worth pursuing, but, for good reasons, not cracking cybersecurity or defeating cybersecurity systems, but also for, you know, formulating or devising materials that don't exist today and that have properties that could be hugely beneficial, even in terms of energy generation. Back to net control.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's a promise in modeling quantum mechanics in quantum computers. Again, this is very early times. There's no real proof of it. It's the hopes and prayers of many researchers, and so chances are we will get information from it, but, you know, if people out there unfortunately get the idea that it's just a glorified silicon supercomputer, and it's not. It's a whole different animal, and it's very kind of, it's not something that most people can wrap their head completely around, much like quantum mechanics in general. It is, you know, as the great physicist once said, if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you don't. That was Richard Feynman, by the way.
Yep, he was pretty key. Okay, I guess I've exhausted all I've got to say, but it's an interesting topic.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, you know, I hope to be able to kind of talk about it in the future, giving you new information. I was a little bit surprised when I dug deeply and found that the only numbers they factored was 3 and 5 and 15. But still, the promise is great, and I don't think they're really spending that much money on it. I mean, these machines cost millions of dollars, but, you know, AI is throwing away trillions. So I look forward to new information about the subject.
Well, it's kind of interesting that the government has gotten itself involved with cold fusion or whatever, that some big investments that I read about, which I'm not too up on, but I see that that's become a thing again. I always thought that, you know, all the experiments with trying to do fusion were doomed to failure because of, you know, physical reasons, but apparently it's become a thing again, and there are some generators that are using fusion as a principle now and actually making electricity.
Okay, there's a very big difference between fusion and cold fusion. Cold fusion doesn't exist. Cold fusion was a couple of chemists made an announcement that they discovered it, and everyone who checked their notes and tried to run the experiment couldn't reproduce it. And they basically, I think they both passed away by now. This was back in the 80s. So cold fusion doesn't really happen. fusion happens. Fusion happens on the sun. You know, while we're talking, there is fusion going on in the core of our sun. So it's possible to do. Can you do it on an individual basis? Can you do it on a generator on the Earth? That's where problems are. There's a few different technologies that can produce fusion. The problem is, obviously, you want to generate more energy from fusion than it takes to produce the fusion. As long as it's, you know, if someone will give you a dollar bill, but you have to give them $3 in exchange, that's not great economy. That's not very useful. So the problem is finding a technology that's capable of outputting more energy than you have to input it. Let me drop for a second so I don't time out again. Okay. Now, there's a tokamak. There's squeezing deuterium and tritium together in magnetic toroids and compressing them to the point where you provoke them to fuse. And there's laser methods where you put the deuterium and tritium in a little teeny pellet and you focus a lot of lasers at the pellet that compresses it under high temperatures and induces fusion. Now, both of those things can produce fusion, but not as much energy is produced than it takes to generate them. A couple of years ago, they made a big announcement that the lasers are able to, if you consider the amount of laser energy that's used to produce the fusion, you get more energy out of the fusion. The problem is they didn't mention that it's not only the energy contained in the laser beam, but the amount of energy that you have to feed the laser to generate the beam. The efficiency of these lasers is only 1%, so you're still putting in a lot more power than you're taking out. So in principle, again, fusion is possible, and we keep on saying 20 years. It is theoretically possible. Some very clever person will figure out some very clever means to have fusion generation. At this point, not really. It's not efficient enough. But there's no indication that it's inherently impossible, and so the profit, if you come up with a secret, is worth your weight in antimatter. So that's my two cents on fusion.
Yeah, very good. I don't know why I said cold fusion. I remember that whole fiasco with cold fusion, and it got exposed. Yeah. But, yeah, what you say is well taken, but, as technology advances and science advances, maybe they'll come up with it. But and they sure would like to, because then they have a limitless.
Yeah, I think ultimately there's nothing to be lost from research, especially in practical fields. You never know what will be discovered. That's why it's so difficult to predict the future. That's why popular science, if it was around to this day, would still be issuing covers where they promise that in 20 years there'll be flying cars.
Well, again, quantum computing could definitely aid in all these efforts. Or at least make them a little timelier. Okay, I'm sure there are other people waiting to talk. KATUTF.
Comment.
Yes, Wesley?
Yeah, I'm here. I was on the echoing, but I lost the connection, so. You said I don't understand what I take for stages 000, whatever. So I was talking about two beats, so you have. So if you have a two beats, you have a combination 00, 01, 10, and 11. And of course, each beat can take only two stages, 01. But the reason that I was talking about it was that in qubit we have multiple stages simultaneously, but only one outcome. So what did we have in four stages? We have only one outcome in the unit of time. So only the processing power makes it faster. But still, if we're talking about computers having 1,121 qubits at IBM Condor, I believe that is the most advanced quantum computers that we have right now. We're talking about Atari computing power comparing to what we have today. Back to you.
You got to look at polynomial time and...
I think that the record so far is 6,100 qubits. That's at Caltech.
We have a 61. So you're talking about 61,000 or 6,100?
6,100.
So still computing power is not great. And still we have four simultaneous stages, but only one outcome. So what is the advantage? It's only computing power, but you...
Again, I'm not quite sure why you're talking about nibbles. Yeah, I mean, you could talk about bits, you could talk about bytes, you could talk about any number of binary arrays, but, you know, the fundamental situation is the individual bit versus the qubit. And qubits can have severe number of superpositions simultaneously. A bit can't have more than one position at any time. It doesn't have a superposition. Quantum mechanics has superpositions. Regular electronic silicon-based bits and bytes and nibbles and what have you only have a single outcome. They don't have a super condition.
Okay, so we have multiple stages at the same time, but we have only one outcome. So if we're talking about four stages and compare it with the time, a unit of time, okay, so we have four stages, and four stages takes four times. We in qubits we have four simultaneous stages, but only one outcome. So what is faster? Back to you.
I don't think you could really kind of do that, especially on a radio, especially with people who are quantum mechanics experts. It's not a matter, they're not comparable. They're completely different things. They operate on different bases. They require different designs. They require different algorithms. And you can't kind of translate one to the other. There's no kind of regular computer that we use every day where if you tweak the specs large enough, you end up with a quantum computer. It's kind of like saying, can you adjust an elephant so that he becomes a giraffe?
I agree with what you're saying. What I'm saying is that I rather agree with prediction that it takes many years before we would be able to have significant power on quantum computers compatible with what technology will bring at the same time in advances of traditional technology. I mean, traditional. Because we're not standing at the same... What happened with the Moore's Law? Back to you.
The Moore's Law?
No, the Moore's Law.
Moore's Law is not a real thing. I mean, if you violate the laws of thermodynamics, you don't get a fine or a bill. It just doesn't work. Moore's Law is just an observation that they've kind of tweaked and moved around a bit to make it seem as though it's continued. But as far as Moore's law is concerned, the size of even chips, discrete components on silicon are kind of being fudged. You know, sometimes you'll read about 4-nanometer fabrication of integrated circuits, and if you were able to kind of zoom in on it and take a tape measure and measure it, it wouldn't be 4 nanometers. It's a kind of a fudge number that the fabricators tend to use to promote their higher technology. They're putting components on their side and doing all kinds of weird things, or stacking them three-dimensionally to approximate something that might have 4 nanometers, but that's not really a thing. So Moore's law is just an interesting kind of fairy tale that we tell each other that for a while kind of fit rather nicely and surprisingly to all of us. But, you know, we're no longer on the curve for Moore's law, really.
Yeah, actually, you should look at Born's rule, B-O-R-N. It gives the probability of finding a given particle, the probability density, as they call it, for finding a particle at a given position. And it's according to the amplitude and the wave function. It's quite a complex thing.
Okay,
I'm not sure how to see the ability to find the position of the particle, which is not doable. How that has to do something with the quantum computing using qubits, I'm not sure how to relate those two phenomena. Back to you, Dr.
Yeah, I think for some reason we're colliding with the uncertainty principle, which is another thing entirely. It's a characteristic of quantum mechanics, but really doesn't have anything to do with Moore's law.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, that's correct. What I'm saying is, if it's not that I should say, okay, we have four solutions at the same time in quantum computing, but only one outcome in the given time, at the given time, right? How that correlates with higher speed comparing to the traditional technology, because it takes less time for qubits to process the data. Is that what we should take as a given? Back to you.
Again, unfortunately, with my limited understanding of quantum computers, it doesn't quite work that way. You develop an array of qubits. You organize them in a particular structure, and then when you collapse their waveform, the qubits settle for a distinct value. That value is the solution to that particular algorithm. It doesn't work to kind of try and figure it in terms of your basic silicon binary-based computers. They work completely different. So, you know, trying to kind of find some way of kind of cramming a binary computer into a quantum computer is sort of a pointless exercise as far as I'm aware of.
That would be correct, what you're saying. But in the essence, we're talking about the time consumed. So we're talking about the time per physical calculation, physical process of a bit being processed. We're talking about calculation. So we're talking about... we want a quantum computer to make the processing faster. Is that correct?
Well, effectively, what you're doing, you're using a completely different method that will give you a solution to the problem orders of magnitude faster. Again, if you wanted to factor two large prime numbers using a regular supercomputer, you know, if it was more than, you know, 20 digits long, it would take the fastest standard binary computer centuries to solve it, simply because the methods that are available to that device, you know, take a long time to process. The algorithms are not easy, and they don't run fast. Quantum computers operate on a completely different level. It's not that you're crunching the numbers at a faster rate. It's that you have all the solutions to the equation simultaneously in the entangled qubits, and when you collapse them, you get an answer. So the time interval isn't the important factor with quantum computing. You do need to have stability of the entanglement, because if the quantum computer entanglement collapses before you're ready for it, you don't get the right answer.
Okay, thank you very much, and Trixie.
Has an interesting characteristic, Roy.
Say again?
I guess this is bringing it a full circle, but going back to the crypto security part of it, the fact that when you interrogate an entangled system like that, it collapses. Is very good for cybersecurity in a sense, because if you have an encrypted system that depends on entanglement and somebody tries to use a backdoor to interrogate it, it will collapse into a conventional system and you'll be aware of the intruder.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Chinese have been experimenting with that aspect of quantum security. It gets rid of the man-in-the-middle methods of breaking codes.
Yeah, that's so that you can see the potential for a secure system that way. Nobody will be able to crack it because it will reveal the attempt to interrogate it instantly.
Well, yeah, as long as you're using man-in-the-middle type of methods. If you find some other interesting way, if you bug the guy on the other end, then you get around that quantum encryption method. But yeah, there are some very intriguing things. Again, the Chinese have published reports that they've been playing around with that method of encryption proofing, you know, transmissions and such. So yeah, there's a lot of promise in all these things. You never quite know how long it's going to take and how much of the theoretical items will come to fruition in a meaningful way, but you don't know until you try.
Well, I hope that we're in the back room somewhere trying.
Yeah, I'm sure someone is, more than someone. A lot of people are, because, you know, you publish or perish, but, you know, everyone kind of wants one of those lovely little Nobel Prizes.
So I've heard.
Well, we'll see what the future brings us. As I repeatedly say, we kind of live in a golden age of technology. The advancements taking place worldwide have never kind of gone at the rate that they're going these days. I only hope that a lot of the discoveries are discovered here in the good old U.S. of A., and because I don't particularly trust the Chinese. Apparently, from the way some people are talking about tonight, they don't trust them either. I have nothing against the country, the ethnicity. I just don't trust the Chinese Communist Party.
Concur. Thanks for the participation. KATUTF.
Roy Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf is standing by.
Yes, Sam, it's your turn now. I hope we gave you enough time to build up the audience.
Thanks, Roy. Anyway, Roy, I'm contemplating purchasing an antenna analyzer, and I was wondering if any of the members online have one and their opinion of maybe the rig expert match as a new good one to get. So that's what I'll put on the table tonight. Thank you, Roy.
Okay, very good. I have a rig expert. I have three VNAs. I have an AIM 4300, which is a little box, and you plug it into a computer and you look at the screen. Rig Expert is much more portable. You can hang it from your belt. It has a nice display. And, it has some push buttons, and I like it. It's good. Unfortunately, the power regulating chip burnt out for no apparent reason once upon a time. And although I think the company is either in Estonia or Ukraine, they have a guy who lives in Canada and travels back and forth between the New York City, Canada border and picks up and fixes things and sends them back. And they fixed mine without charging me anything. So, you know, I'm a big fan of them. If anyone has any opinions about VNAs, especially rig experts, please, Sam wants to know your opinion.
Easy to build.
Yeah, Jeff?
I don't know if they're considered VNAs. There's a, but they might be scalar. They might be vector. And they're definitely, I think, of Chinese origin. But the AAI RF vector impedance analyzer, the one that I have that I really like is the N-November 20161 Sierra Alpha, and it covers from zero, covers from DC to like maybe 1.8 gigahertz. And it's a nice device. It's not particularly accurate in terms of frequency, and you know you've got your problem sampling problems, but it is good for a first pass to tell you where an antenna is going to be resonant. And it will tell you the reactance going which way. If you are interested in, you know, adding capacitance or inductance to zero something out, it will give you those sorts of measurements. Again, it's a handheld device. It's got an internal battery. Its accuracy is questionable, but it is a good first pass device, and it's pretty cheap. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. It sounds the way you're describing it like it's a vector network analyzer. Scalar network analyzers wouldn't be able to actually tell you how to correct the impedance. It just gives you absolute numbers without the degrees, you know, what angle the impedance is at. So it sounds like it's a vector.
Yeah, I can't speak to the accuracy of the vector analysis, so I prefer to think of everything as a scalar device until it's actually proved itself as a vector device.
Okay, I just kind of think in terms of things that are precise, accurate, or just kind of a guess. But, okay, you're free to, because hardly anyone talks about a scalar network analyzer these days. They kind of existed for a while right before vector network analyzers became approachable financially, because in the old days it would be nothing to spend $15,000 for a VNA. You know, thankfully those days are gone, but I think that was the reason why some people who just couldn't pay a bill like that had scalar network analyzers.
Yeah, Roger. I mean, a lot of the devices that I have some that are definitely scalar devices, and they're older and they're used equipment and all that. I definitely have some vector devices, and you pay more for that. But the people who want the scalar devices are, you know, paying for something that does precisely that. They're just looking for a frequency response, and they're not looking for how to correct it. They know how to correct it, and they just want to know exactly where the observed notch is or something like that on the top of a roof or in the back of a building or whatever you mean.
Yeah, there's a place for almost every tool. Anyone else with any comments, especially if any of you rig expert people would like to to say whether you like the product or hate the product. I don't know of anyone who hates the product. You know, we've had a few people who bought, for a time, Rigsexpert was selling kits where it was just a circuit board. You know, you had to either get a box, make a box yourself, or just kind of use it indoors, because otherwise if it rained on it, it would ruin the damn thing. They got a very inexpensive model. I don't know if they sell those anymore. I prefer the full size and covered Rigsexpert. You know, you want something durable. If you break it, if you take it outdoors and it gets rain on it, you wipe it off and you go about your business, as opposed to the you know, just the inexpensive electrical circuit that's usually in some of these things. But anyway, getting back, if anyone has had any Rigsexperts and has any opinions, please feel free to share.
One more comment, Roy.
Sure.
Yeah, I do have the HF version of the early version of the Rigsexpert, not the kit version, but you know, the kind where you push the buttons. And I absolutely used it every single day when I was early on when I was building my HF antennas. Very, very nice device. Very usable, very easy, very intuitive, and indestructible. AC2PL, Mexinet.
Okay, very good. Did you notice the weirdness that the firmware came in two versions? There was the USA firmware and the non-USA firmware.
I never updated the firmware, and what I had was easily, I guess, identifiable as USA-based. I don't know exactly how you differentiate, but I'm assuming there would be meters per second and versus kilometers or miles or whatever, or, you know, bald eagles per 45 ACP.
No, that isn't it. Apparently the story went that someone in the United States patented a VNA that uses Smith charts. And so Rigsexpert for a time could not include Smith charts in their USA models. So the way that they covered it was they just had USA firmware that took out the Smith chart. And if you had the non-USA firmware, it included the Smith chart as one of the functions on it.
It was a lower version that I don't think ever had a Smith chart, but that does bring back some memories of people who, in my field, patented you know, certain volumes of things added to other volumes of things, and it turns out that companies were so scared of that they would never add a particular volume of one thing to another thing.
Yeah, that's where the law kind of produces all kinds of weird pseudo-technology. But that's the reason that I discovered. So, you know, people who were inclined, you know, some people didn't really want to look at a Smith chart, but the people inclined would just download the non-USA and, you know, burn that firmware into the Rigsexpert, and they had their Smith charts, and thankfully lawyers didn't sue them.
Roy?
Yes, Sam.
How significant is the Smith chart? Because it is an additional option on the model that I'm contemplating getting.
It depends on the individual. For probably 95% of us, it probably isn't worth much, because it usually engenders much more confusion than understanding. You know, the concept, I guess, is more is better than less. And again, my guess is that if you have two, I don't know if Rigsexpert has it's the same Michigas, but you know, if they do, most likely they offer you both types of firmware, and it's just, you know, spending 5 minutes in front of a computer to just kind of download the latest non-USA firmware, and you two probably would have the Smith charts. But I don't think you'd ever find any particular practical use for it. They, you know, as a, you know, as a, you know, as the the typical amateur radio operator. If you're an electrical engineer and you love to get into the grass, then Smith charts can be fascinating under some circumstances. But again, for a lot of people, it tends to be more confusing than anything else.
Thank you for your input, and I will certainly take that into account. The model that I'm thinking of buying is the Rig Expert Match, and it's the only one that's not on sale, so it's like the latest version, and it is a full piece, you know what I mean, as opposed to the new sticks that they're promoting. But I'm tending to buy the bigger one that has the ruggedness that you suggested. But the match has, for $100, you can add the Smith chart to it. And I was just contemplating whether or not that's that money that's well spent. Anyway, I appreciate you getting the word out, and I'm still listening. It's been very, very enlightening tonight. Thank you, Roy.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if my choices was $100 more for a Smith chart, I don't think I would invest. I don't think it's quite worth for hams $100. But, you know, that's a decision everyone, I guess, has to make for themselves. That's a shame that they put it behind a wall for $100. I don't know if the rationale is that they pay the patent holder a piece of that action or what's going on with them. But it's kind of sad to hear that in the old days, like I said, you just downloaded firmware and burned it in and you had the feature. So it's a sign of the times, I guess. Any other comments on VNAs and rig experts and what have you, feel free to hit that push to talk. Okay, I guess not. A while ago, David checked in. David, are you still there? Okay, I guess he stepped away. Anyway, I'm AC2GS. This is the Widemark Technical Net. We still have 20 minutes if someone wants to use it. If you have any questions or comments or topics or something popped into your head during the last 2 hours that you'd like to address, feel free. Hit that push to talk and ID yourself.
Just one comment.
Sure, Jeff.
PC2PL. The comment is the following. These handheld devices all have a frequency reference that's on board. So we all assume everything we pick up is, yeah, the frequency is great. You turn on a radio, yeah, the frequency it displays is exactly what it is. And the reality of the fact is none of them are even close to being exactly accurate. And if they are, it's an accident. The Chinese device I was telling you about earlier is off by a particular number of kilohertz that I have marked on the back. And I have found no way to actually correct it without destroying the device, and I don't actually want to do that. All of my radios are off by a known amount, and I have, you know, lab grade references in the shack here to correct things if I really want to take off the cover and tweak the VCOs and all that. But it's worth mentioning that the lower you go down on the totem pole, the possibility of being off frequency by quite a bit is actually very real, and nobody ever really pays attention to it. QSL?
Yeah, well, I mean, unfortunately, that's the nature of the beast. Usually between calibrated lab equipment and consumer, just kind of get it someplace close. I mean, 99 times out of 100 for the average amateur radio operator, the drift of the frequency generator doesn't really affect what you're doing. You're trying to look for a for a resident area, and, you know, if you're off by a couple of kilocycles one way or the other? I mean, how wide off frequency, except for things that are just broken, have you measured?
With older Kenwoods, I've actually found devices that were off so much so that the, you know, it was audibly different. And, you know, the people that were used to using old devices, FT-101s and all that, would just, you know, tweak the VFO. But the point is, we have factory manuals and specifications for all stages of all the electronics and internal to all these devices. And if you're in the business of putting something on the bench, taking apart, fixing it, you want to make sure everything is aligned. So, yeah, you want to have a lab-grade satellite-based or, you know, whatever it is, rubidium-based frequency reference. And, yes, you will find devices that someone hands you, and they say, I don't know what's wrong with this, and you align it, and then all of a sudden everything's fine. So it definitely happens, and it happens with every single ham radio device I've ever laid hand on has been off by a certain number of hertz or kilohertz.
Okay, yeah, I mean, things just drift. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. You could limit it to one degree or another. You know, you could put a crystal encased in an oven and keep the temperature stable. But you know, the ultimate lab equipment that's, you know, 0% off is a dream that we aspire to, but most of us never get anywhere near.
Correct. KD2FIU.
Thank you, George. It's a story about the man who owns one clock knows what time it is, and the man who owns two clocks will never know what time it is.
Yeah, we kind of went down this road a couple of months ago. I think it was Brian. He had a couple of watt meters that were reading different numbers, and we were talking about how I have far too many clocks in front of me right now, because I have two computers, I have an iPad, and I have an actual clock. And most of them are actually calibrated, the network time protocol, except for the generic clock that's just sitting on the side of my desk, which is drifting off a little bit. But, yeah, it's, you know, that's the problem. A lot of people don't mind having different clocks with different times, and other people, it drives them insane.
KD2FIU, Roy, can I have some input?
Sure.
I have Boonton, B-O-O-N-T-O-N, electronic equipment. Some of it is really, really incredibly sensitive, RF millivolt meters and scoping with it. I found that also analog meters are very, very important when having it. And occasionally I will send them out back to Boonton, but to a lab in California to recalibrate them every few years. But when it comes back, it's not even really worth it that it has gone up such a small amount to give me a fraction of an RF millivolt that is off that I'm scoping and looking at. So if it's a good piece of equipment, keep it, hold on to it. Don't expose it to any ESD, don't bang it around or something like that, and you'll always have a good time with it.
Very good, and it's always good advice to be nice to your equipment. Your equipment is nice to you. You should do the same thing with it. Respect. I've always kind of had respect for equipment. I've had respect for books. I'm one of those strange guys. If you went to my library and looked at the bindings, you couldn't tell which book I've read and which book I haven't read, because I respect books, but I also respect electronic equipment. You know, it's sad to see a chassis bent and dented, and just kind of messed up with. People who, I don't know, don't seem to have respect for property either. So I agree with you.
I found that analog scoping stays within specs longer than digital scoping. And it is easier to read. KD2FIU.
Okay, I guess, part of it is just being used to things.